Hello, and welcome to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Goodwin, your host. This podcast is dedicated to the aspiring writer or artist and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field, along with contest winners and a few surprise guests. Today we are speaking with a winner going all the way back to 1993. Welcome, Stoney Compton.
Thank you. I'm very, very happy to be here.
Yeah, I was watching checking a past winner, and they talked about all your books. I said, Stoney, I haven't talked to him forever. And so I wrote to you, and then here we are. So that's great. So what's been happening?
Well, all kinds of things. I've been close to pumping out a book a year now for the last 4 years. And two of the books, alternative history books, were published through Ring of Fire Press. Of course, that's Eric Flint, and he and I were in the same year together at Writers of the Future. In fact, he beat me out for first place in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
But I'm quite happy with that. He also helped me get my foot in the door with Bain with my first novel, which is also an alternative history. I write historical fiction and science fiction and alternative history. And I've been working quite hard for, well, a number of years.
Yeah.
On what I call the Gastineau Channel Quartet. And it's about Southeast Alaska, 1915 through 1945. It's four separate books. And they're all really long. But anyway, I don't want to get off on that yet.
Yeah, we'll get there, but not quite yet.
But 10 days ago, Walt Boyes, who is Eric's editor-in-chief for Ring of Fire, called me up and said, we're getting Cecilia Holland to publish. Ring of Fire Press is going to publish her. And since we're doing historical fiction, we want to republish your historical fiction books also. And while we're at it, we're going to pick up, if you want, everything else you've written.
So, wow.
I said, yeah, because most of my stuff has been self-published. And what I've discovered about self-publishing is, well, I get along with the editor. I don't have any marketing people. I'm it.
Yeah.
Everything. And you can't, that's a full-time job.
Yeah, so, it is.
So that's pretty exciting for me. So now I don't have to even worry about marketing. I can just write and research.
That's great. So now, how did your career, or how did your love with the muse of writing actually get started?
Oh boy! I've been a visual artist forever. I think I started drawing when I was 8, and I got my college degree in I majored in American history, art, and education.
Yeah.
And I was going to be a teacher, and I did my student teaching and decided I can handle the children, I can handle the students, I can't handle the administration. So I didn't do that. I was a graphic artist for many, many years. I lived in Juneau. I lived in Alaska 31 years. I went up for a summer and spent 31 winters. And I loved it.
Yeah.
It was all an adventure. But I was working, I had my own studio in downtown Juneau, and I was doing freelance graphics on the side to support the studio and the family, and I had two contracts with the state of Alaska, which were quite lucrative, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And this was 1987, and Alaska has, their economy up there is different than down here in the lower 48. It's whole different set of circumstances, and the price of oil dropped. I don't know if you remember that back in those days. And the state of Alaska runs on oil money.
Ran on gold dust. I thought you just went to the pulled out your gold dust, pull out your packet, and bought your loaf of bread with however much gold dust.
Not too many people do that anymore.
Okay,
but so I was working in my studio as I was doing paintings, and I'm a printmaker, and I had my own etching press and the whole nine yards. And I was working away on some prints, and phone rang, and it was one of my contacts at the state, and he canceled the contract I had with his department, and I no more than hung up than the other guy called and canceled the other one. So suddenly I had no income, and so I had to move everything out of my I had to give up the studio and move everything into a little closet in our house that we lived in, my first wife and two kids and her sister and her daughter and I. There wasn't room for a studio.
Right.
There was a closet that I could set up as a writing office. So I went out and I bought an Amiga computer, and I was playing with the idea of writing a book, and then I stumbled across the first volume of Writers of the Future, Volume 1. And I read the whole thing. I thought it had a contest in it, so I spent the money. And I read that, and I thought, well, some of these are really good, and some of these I know I can write better. And so I started writing short stories. I'd get ideas, and I'd write them. And my first one I sent, I got a,
honorable mention?
There you go. Honorable mention. And Al just Budrys, good old AJ, wrote on the top of it, he said, "This is great as far as it goes, but where you're at, where you ended is where the story really starts." And I thought about it, and he was right, and that turned into a novel later. And I had another honorable mention. I forget which story it was, but it took me, from when I saw Volume 1, which is probably, they were working on Volume 2 at the time, I didn't get in until 9.
Right.
So it took longer than I thought it would, but I learned a whole lot in that sphere. And I also, during that time, sold a novelette to Bob Silverberg for his Universe One anthology, which was a real, boy, I thought I had it made. he liked my story, and he sent the manuscript back. This was, before computers, or before they were used that way. And on the outside of the packet, he'd written in big letters, "Not to worry." And what he'd done is he'd gone through my manuscript and edited it. And he said, "Okay, be in the edits. Change, and I need this changed and this changed. Don't make it in too much longer because it's already pretty long and we have a sale." And he says, "Get it back to me at least within a month." He had it back in 3 days. and I was a published author, which that's a pretty nice feeling.
I'm sure. Yeah, and Bob was one of our founding judges for the Writers of the Feature Contest.
No, I don't know if he was in 93 or not.
Yeah, he was from the very beginning.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was one of our founding judges. Yeah. So he's been with us all along.
I think but they blind judged them, right?
Yeah. So you have no idea that it was you. Yeah.
Other than the fact that it was also about Alaska. But
so that's a great story. So then when you came out then for where was the Writers of the Future workshop held that year?
They would. They're at the headquarters, I guess.
Okay, good. Here at Author Services.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so what was it like that week?
Well, of course, the coolest part about it was the fact that they paid for my way from Alaska down to Hollywood and put me up for a week and shipped me back. I mean, that was a first since the Navy, and it was a whole different stick then. but the I went down there thinking, boy, this is going to be a week-long party, and they had us booked from morning till night, one thing after another. It was pretty rigorous, as I remember, but enjoyable.
Yeah.
And in fact, I got to one point where I realized that I was running out of time. And because I couldn't really afford to stay down there on my own and not having a job. But I took one afternoon, I skipped one afternoon and went out and bought some trinkets and stuff to take back to the family. But that was the only time I had off from the whole thing. And it was intensive, but it was very illuminating.
Yeah.
It was really neat to sit down and talk to people. You've seen their names on books and stuff. and here you are, they're chatting with you about how to do it. That was pretty spectacular, especially, you know, from the boonies where I was.
Yeah, I see a picture in this, in our 25-year book, you know, here. Yeah. There's a picture of you there in the album there with...
Fred Poole.
Yeah, Fred Poole, right?
Yeah.
And there was Jack Williamson was there. Sean Williams also won that year.
Yeah, he did. We had a blast. The night of the awards ceremony, afterward, we managed to purloin most of the beer that was left. We went out and had a hot tub out there and partied until they came out and told us we had to shut up and go to bed. But it was really neat. Sean and Eric, of course, still only made it for the last 2 days because he couldn't get off from work.
Right.
And and Deb Hudak and Elizabeth Ween.
Yeah.
It was cool to meet all these folks then and watch them blossom since. It's really cool. And I'm still in touch with most of them. And actually went to see Charlie Saplak. That's been 20 years ago now, though, in Virginia when my son and I did a road trip.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a lot of the folks, I don't see their name out there, which doesn't mean they're not writing.
Right.
A lot of people don't see my name out there either.
And you're still writing.
Stopped writing.
So that's good. So are you familiar with any of the L. Ron Hubbard books or essays?
I actually, I've done a lot of research on my historical fiction, especially the part, I've got the first two books of the quartet written, and the next two are in the 30s and then World War II when Alaska was a war zone. And in researching it, I came across Hubbard's name in relationship to him being in Ketchikan.
Yeah.
Which is just south of Juneau, where most of the stuff takes place, although I do have scenes in Ketchikan in the other books. But I started looking up all this stuff, and I found that an article about him that had been written, I believe, by the Sitka Sentinel, I'm not sure who, and that he had been a radio disc jockey and all that, and was really into researching white noise.
Yeah.
And that he had... in fact, uncovered a Nazi spy, and I can't find any more information on this. Driving me nuts. If you have more information on that, I'd love to hear it.
I will definitely send it to you. There's the guy who was the manager of KTKN Radio, who was where Ron Hubbard had a regular show on there while he was there in Ketchikan. And by the way, just a bit of digression, that's where he created his first writing competition, the Golden Pen Award in Ketchikan, to the people there. So that's where he got the idea, which later then became the awards of the Golden Pen Award and the Golden Brush Award for the Writers of the Future contest. But it originally started there in Ketchikan, Alaska. But he was there. He was flying the flag with the Explorers Club on that trip to Ketchikan. But he was also doing some research for the U.S. Navy on what was LORAN, long-range navigation, and when he, and that equipment would help him find there was this signal that was blocking, found out it was a German saboteur, so he found him. But there's a whole thing in there from the manager of KTKN talking about that, so I'll send you that letter.
I'd appreciate that very much.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. I've been to Ketchikan a few times, and I love it. It's absolutely beautiful. I learned after the first hour or so, you don't use umbrellas. I went walking.
No.
I had my umbrella, and I was walking. I said, it's raining, and nobody has it. I'm the only umbrella. So I quickly folded it up and just got wet, went into the nearest place and bought myself a little cap, a hat, and then wore the hat and just never pulled out the umbrella again.
Yeah, it's, all of Southeast is, well, it's rainforest. And I lived in Juneau for 16 years, and well, supposedly here in Oregon it rains, but
no,
not compared to that.
No.
Now, in fact, Ketchikan, if you go out, get on a float plane and go out there 15 minutes, you hit Annette Island, and that's where I did my student teaching.
Wow.
Was out during the back in the state operated school system days.
Yeah.
But it was interesting too. I was because I was working with Tsimshian kids at Anet Island is a Tsimshian Indian Reserve, and there was the Tsimshian kids, and then there was the Coast Guard kids because that's where the big Coast Guard base was then.
Sure. Yeah.
Sitka. But it was a very interesting time. It was at a point where the Tsimsheans had figured out that they had sold their traditional heritage for white middle class values. A lot of them weren't happy about it. So it was a very dynamic time to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But still in contact with some of those folks too. But
he actually wrote a book. He published it after the war on when he was there in Ketchikan. It was because he was doing a bunch of research also, like on the Tlingit Indians, and he found some interesting research that, because he traveled over the world, and he actually found that no matter where you were, everybody had their own version of the Great Flood in their ancient history. So he found out there was that there too. But it was he wrote a book called The Chechaker, and it was about Ketchikan. So
Chechako is a term for the newbie.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what this was about. So it's a good story. I'll send that to you as well. So you can get something about Alaska. It's a story about Alaska.
That's the thing I like most about writing historical fiction, or even alternative history, because you want to get it right. You want to make it feel right. And research is the answer. With Treadwell, my first one in the Gastineau Channel Quartet, I researched for 8 months at the Alaska State Museum, Library and Museum in Juneau, before I even started writing. And then it took me 10 years to write the book.
Yeah.
And 10 years of logging it and people reading it and saying, it's too long. You're a new, no one knows your name. We can't publish a book this long. And I finally gave up and self-published it. Got into it.
Yeah, well, that's good. So so your life, obviously, after winning the contest, you've written, what, a dozen novels?
I'm coming up on a dozen.
Yeah.
But, and it's, I keep starting series and not finishing them, which I have to stop doing that. Right now I'm working on, I was working on the third book in the Gastineau Channel Quartet, what I do is I, through interlibrary loan, I get microfilm copies of all the newspapers for that time. It's the daily newspaper, well, except Sundays. They didn't publish Sundays back then.
Mm-hmm.
And I take them to the library. I go to the library and I scan them, every page.
Yeah.
And turn it into a JPEG or a PDF and bring it home. And that way I can sit there and peruse it at my leisure. And I was in the process of scanning the papers from 1932 to 1936 I'm at 1934 now, when the pandemic hit and everything closed up. So I'm stuck because I've learned that I really need to know everything that happened before I get in there and start building stories and building the novel.
Well, that's what builds so much realism in a story. It's like it makes it, you're willing, yeah. Okay, this is believable. Okay, now where does the fiction come in? Because everything else is grounded in believability.
Exactly. And I also, the other thing I like about it is I actually use images of the front pages and a lot of the ads as spacers between the chapters, which that way, if they just scan the newspaper front page, they know what's going on in the world that I'm trying to create. So it beats doing a big information dump.
Yeah.
And it gives it more verisimilitude, I think. And it, well, the two that I've got out, the people who have read them like them. Oh, 9 of them.
Yeah. So are you making a living as an author? Are you able to generate enough income that you're living off of your income?
No. I wish. No, if it wasn't for Social Security, I'd be pushing around a grocery cart out in the street. But I thought I could. I was working for the Navy down in Corpus Christi, Texas, from 2012 to 2015, and I discovered that I really didn't like South Texas weather. It's hot, it's humid, and they got lots of bugs. Even mosquitoes. I thought Alaska had the mosquitoes, but they have got a bunch down in Texas too.
Yeah.
So I finally resigned. I said, okay, I'm going to quit. I'm going to go up back to the Pacific Northwest and find work there. Well, ageism's out there, and if you're over 50, it's hard to get a job. But if you're over 60, forget it.
Yeah.
So I finally gave up on looking for work and just started really writing hard. And I'm hoping this new situation with Ring of Fire Press will turn into something a little more lucrative than my Poodle Pup publishing has been. So
Hopefully this will help, because we have a fairly decent listenership to this podcast. So hopefully other people will discover Stone and Compton, want to read your stuff, and they'll talk about it, and just word of mouth has a lot to do with success.
This is true. I used to go to a lot of cons in Texas. I went to one in Dallas, and I went to one in Houston, and also one in Austin, and tried to do that each year, and I'd drive to them, which Texas is an awfully large state. I thought Alaska was big, but there's not that much road in Alaska, but boy, in Texas, it just can go forever.
Yeah.
But I don't go down there anymore, but I do go to Oricon, but now, with the COVID thing, there aren't any cons. So it's kind of hard to get your name out there or talk to people about it, the people that don't know you already.
Mm-hmm.
I have a nice little cadre of folks that keep saying, when are you going to get this out? When are you going to get this out? Which is really nice. I love that.
Yeah.
But I need more of them.
Well, hopefully also with this Ring of Fire Press, it's going to take you to a whole new level.
That is the idea.
Yeah. So are you part of any writing group or any other group you would like to acknowledge?
I used to be, when I lived in Juneau, we started the Rainforest Writers, and we actually put on writers' conferences 3 years running.
Uh-huh.
And we did all the work, and the first one was a 1 day, and the second one was a 2 day, and the third one was a 3 day, and the third one we actually had enough money to bring in people from the lower 48. I brought Chris Rush and Dean Leslie Smith up, and
they're also both judges of the contest,
right? Yeah, and they're friends.
Yeah,
kind of got to meet them. Yeah, I met them back in became aware of them back in the Pulp House days. When they were putting out their magazine, and
mm-hmm.
I still have a whole row of those, but it was a real beautiful conference, and we had people come to it from all over Alaska and the Yukon, and I thought, all right, we're finally going to be real. And I started talking to people about next year, and they said, we've done it, we're done. So anyway, that was about it. I left Juneau. My life changed a whole lot right then. I got divorced, and I left Juneau and was in Anchorage working for the state of Alaska. And then finally, after 31 years, my mom was diagnosed with inoperable cancer, and I knew if I didn't go down and hang out with her, I'd regret it. So I quit my job and went to Colorado, and she passed away about 4 months after that. So I was glad I did it.
Yeah.
Even though I couldn't find work there either, and it took me a year to get out of Colorado, get back to the Pacific Northwest. But yeah, it's my writing life has had to fit in around my work life, and my work life has been totally chaotic. Always has been. Make a list of the things that I've done in my life, and I even find it a little, are you crazy? But anyway, it's.
But now you've got writing as a life.
Yes, exactly.
That's
writing and taking care of our cats and dogs and taking hikes and, yeah.
Well, good. So on the With the current publishing scene, like you said, you went self-publishing, now you're with the Ring of Fire Press. Do you have any of your own perspective of the future, how things are going with... Because you've been doing your self-publishing up to this recent point, so what's your take on publishing and making it as an author?
Oh, boy. Well, I listened to a number of your podcasts while I was sitting here doing graphics for... I also do my own book covers, or I did. That might have changed, too. But I was listening to Bob Silverberg chat with, and he kind of dissed...
self-publishing,
and I thought, well, you know, that maybe that was true back then, but it's not now. There's too many gatekeepers and not enough gates right now in publishing. You have to have an agent. So okay, realistically, there goes a percentage of anything they'll ever make forever, and then you get a cut from the publisher of what it is, and it's nowhere near, unless you do a bestseller or a blockbuster or something, you're not going to get rich. I remember when Bain published my first novel back in 2006, I was working in Seattle for this environmental engineering company. And one of my coworkers, very sweet lady, said, "Stoney, you're a published author now. Are you going to quit your job?" Oh dear. But yeah, the thing is, self-publishing, I know a lot of people who started and then they just gave up. And the thing about giving up is then you kind of always wonder if you could have done it. Mm-hmm. So you just have to keep pushing it. Perseverance is the hardest part of writing. Even when you get frustrated and pissed off, you can't let that stop you. You have to keep. And it isn't like I just write something and throw it out there. I write the full manuscript out, and then I leave it alone. I try to leave it alone for 2 weeks. It's really hard to do, but I really try. And then I go back and I reread. I read it out loud to myself from beginning to end. And reading it out loud to yourself, you find errors that you didn't realize were there.
Sure.
Because you know what you were thinking when you wrote it, and you just going too fast and skip that the and the F and, you know, this sort of stuff. And you also find misspellings. And so then I go through and I straighten out plot holes that I left wide open or didn't close to start with, things like that. And I get it to where I think, okay, this I think is a viable work. Then I give it to my wife, Lett, who is an excellent editor. And she goes through it with a fine-tooth comb. She gives it back, pages back to me, and there's red here and red there. And she's just doing line edits. She's just finding sentences that don't make sense, things like that. And she's wonderful. And then I have some beta readers that I send it to once she's done with it, and I key in the changes, corrections.
Mm-hmm.
I send it off to the beta readers and tell them, okay, you got a month to get back to me on this, or I'm going to run without you. And some of them make it back, some of them don't. Some of them I'm not sure ever read it, but that's, you know, it's up to them.
Yeah.
They're not getting paid. But at that point, once I get it back from the beta readers and to their concerns or ignore them, that's the other nice thing about it is beta readers are wonderful, but I also tell them, I'm open to any suggestion, but that doesn't mean I'm going to use it. And
right.
I understand that.
Right.
Often I do. Often they make very good points, and I go, oh, yeah. But at that point, that's when I put it into manuscript format, which is a whole lot of work right there.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do one for ebook, and then you have to do a different one for, because I have images in my stuff. So for print on demand, All the images have to be 300 DPI, or they look like garbage on the page.
Mm-hmm.
I do two final ones for each novel, for each manuscript, and it's a lot of work. But I'm very pleased with how they came out. I think I put out a good product, both in terms of story and the way the product looks, the book looks.
Yeah.
Like I said, I do all my covers myself. I do sometimes come across an image that just grabs me, like my one standalone novel, Whale Song, which was the short version of that was the one that AJ said, no, this is where the story starts, and he was right. And so I'd come across this fractal painting online, and I remember just thinking that would be a great cover for Whale Song if I could ever get it published. And I was going to suggest to whoever bought it that they use that. Well, I was the one that published it. So I found the image, wrote to the guy who did it, and asked him what would it cost me to use his image. And he said, it was really neat. He wrote back and says, first, thank you for asking. Most people don't. And he said, secondly, go ahead and use it. I'm glad you like it that well. So I gave him a blurb on the inside cover and everything as who did it. Johnson is the last name. I remember that. But it's been a few years. And I still like it. I still think it's a great cover. And that's the other thing with going with Ring of Fire Press. Eric wants to change the covers on my first two historical novels because he wants to. They're great covers. They're just too historic-y. I want to make them jazzier. So it's going to be interesting to see what they come up with. And I don't know if he's going to change all the rest of my covers or not. But whatever. He's a publisher.
Yeah. Yeah. How did that happen that he just, because you've been friends since you were both winners in Writers of the Future back in 93. So how did it transition? How did it come up that he said, let me publish your books? How did that happen?
We stayed in contact by email after 93, and his son went to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, so he knows Alaska a little bit, and you know the tougher parts to know, like Fairbanks.
Yeah,
I lived there 8 years and still don't know why, but they have horrible winters. But we stayed in contact, and then I was actually talking about my first novel, Russian America, when I first met him, and he told me, he said, when you finish Russian America, let me see it first. So I finished the first draft and got all the real big bugs out of it and splinters and stuff and sent it off to him, and he took him forever to read it because he's constantly writing five books at once.
Yeah.
He is so prolific, it just amazes me. But he finally read it, and he wrote back, and he said, okay, here's what I think. And he went through, and I had him, it's an alternative history about an Alaska that the Russians still owned, and the Athabascans have had it with them, and they're revolting, and there's the lower 48 is balkanized, it's 11 different countries and things like that. And I had jets in it. He says, no, not jets. Give them, it's supposed to be in 1987, I think it was. He said, have their technology be about 1945, just before jets. And things like that, little ideas like that. So I rewrote it and sent it back to him, and he was working with Jim Bain at the time.
Yeah.
He showed the manuscript to Jim, and he sent me copied me on the email that Jim sent him about it. Jim said something to the effect of, okay, he says, this Compton guy really likes these Indians because they seem to be able to do no wrong. He says, I will buy this if you will sign on as editor of it and take a really big stick and hit it a lot. And so I said, okay, I'm not going to agree with that. And so I made some changes to suit Jim. And before it was published, Jim Bain died. And I thought, oh, this is great. My first chance to getting published, and my publisher dies. And so I called Eric, and Eric says, don't worry. He says, Tony's going to pick it up right where Jim left off. And she did. And she also bought the sequel to it. And that's what I'm working on now is the third book in that. And the sequel came out in, what, 20? Mm-hmm. So it's been a while. It's a long time to wait for the third book in the series.
Yeah, but Tony was almost going to be our keynote speaker this past year at a Writers of the Future event, and then COVID hit, and that was that. But she was all set to come out and speak.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's this thing is changing everything about our way of life, at least the social part of it, which was the most important part. I thought, well, unfortunately, politics got into it, and that's really messed up the whole thing.
Yeah.
But we won't go there.
Exactly. I stay totally clear from that. I got friends on both sides of the party line, and so I'm all about books and getting published and recognizing amazing new talents, and I just stay on track with that. Yeah. So any other particular tips you would suggest for aspiring writers as they get started or to take their next step? Because you made comment about the worst thing is that they just don't finish, they don't persevere. So what would you give as a tip or suggestion to overcome that inertia factor as a writer?
I'll meet people and I'll be wearing, I usually wear shirts that are, I'm constantly advertising or trying to. And I have a whole bunch of shirts with my Google Publishing logo on it and stuff. And I'll talk to people, every chance I get, if I'm chatting with somebody in a store or something, I'll just say, do you read for pleasure?
Yeah.
And they either say yes or no. And if they say yes, then I ask, what do they like to read? And if they say science fiction or history or anything like that, then I give them my card and say, check me out, you know. And I make them I give them the guarantee that if they don't like my novel, I'll reimburse them.
Okay.
I don't know anybody else that does that. But I've never reimbursed anybody yet. So either I'm not doing
You're safe.
Bad.
You're safe with that then. You keep on moving.
So far.
You move from state to state to state.
They have to find me first.
Exactly.
But a lot of folks I meet like that will say, you know, I've always wanted to write a book, but I don't know how to start. And I say, it's real easy. You sit down and you write the first line, and then you write the second line, and then the third one. And the longer you write, the more you write, the more of the story will come into your head. About it, when you're doing it by yourself like that, is you can get a whole bunch of lines, and if you don't like any of them, take them out.
Yeah.
A lot of people defeat themselves before they start. So, but the ones that get past that, they do get to the point where they're writing, and it's a fallacy, I think, that people need to start with short stories and then graduate into novels. I frankly find it really tough to write a good short story. I'm too windy. I have all this background and exposition and color and stuff that I find difficult to put into shorthand. I have written some good short stories. I mean, the one that I got published in Volume 9, that's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
That was a miracle story because it came to me in a flash in the middle of of interviewing a guy. I'd been hired by the state of Alaska part-time and splitting a job with a woman. And we were working for the API 2000 project. This was back in the late 80s. And API stands for Alaska Psychiatric Institute. It's the only state-operated mental hospital in the state. And it's in Anchorage, and our office was in Juneau. So our boss sent us down to Anchorage for a tour of the facility. And this fellow is walking around showing us the thing and talking and stuff. And we went back into this one ward where there aren't any, it's kind of hard for them to just, the clients, as they call them, to walk out the door. And there was this wall that was half glass with the little wires running through it, so they couldn't get out even if they broke the glass. And there was this old Eskimo man standing there, and as we were out there chatting, and there was nothing else to look at except us, and he was watching us. And I glanced over at him, and he tapped on the window and pointed at the door. He wanted out. And I kind of shrugged, And then I thought, my God, it must be horrible for him to be in there after living, you know, on the land, in his village, wherever he was from. And all of a sudden, this story just slammed me right in the head. And I started writing notes down, and the guy who was giving us the tour must have thought I was taking notes about it, because he started grinning and he started talking faster. I just kept writing. Got back to my hotel room and wrote out the bones of the story. And when I got back to Juneau, I wrote the whole thing, I think, in 2 days. And it really worked. I loved it. But that doesn't happen often.
Right.
A good short story is a precious jewel. And I'm not that good of a jeweler. It takes me time. I need lots of pages. And so a lot of the new writers think that they have to come up with a whole bunch of winning short stories before they can attempt a novel. That's not true.
Right.
Just start writing that novel. The lovely thing about writing that a lot of new writers seem to think that when they write it down, it's set in stone. It can't be changed. It shouldn't be changed because it's their idea, it's their work. No, it's not perfect. That should be something that should be across everybody, at the top of everybody's computer screen. It's not perfect the first 5 times. I know there's some people who, Dean Wesley Smith, he never rewrites.
Right.
He writes it out there. But he's also been writing for ever.
Yeah, he was the first person to cross the stage in volume 1. He was the first person to ever be presented as a winner for Writers of the Future.
Yeah. Well, and deservedly so. Dean's a good writer. I started writing, I sold my first story in 1988. I'm still rewriting everything because I write too fast. I get in a hurry and I'm zipping along, and I want to ride that wave as far as I can.
Yeah.
And I can always go back and, you know, pick up the pieces if I need to. It's different for everybody. There's no set formula. There's no way you hold your nose or your face when you're writing. It's just be you. A lot of people worry about their writing voice. It's you. It's them. It's however they come across on the page. That's what the reader hears. And as long as they're not trying to emulate or copy somebody else, it's going to be real. It's going to be viable. If they want to be the next, any famous author, they can try to emulate them, but it's going to show.
Mm-hmm.
And, fan fiction is one thing. Using, somebody else's characters, that's fine. Because they inject their own take on it into the story. That's cool. But to try and totally emulate somebody else is just a waste of time.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that, because we've got recently the L. Ron Hubbard Online Writers Workshop, Writers of the Future Online Writing Workshop, that features Orson Scott Card, Tim Powers, and Dave Farland. And
okay.
A lot of what you just said there, Orson Scott Card talks about in voice, talking about, you do it all the time. You speak all the time, just kind of like, you know what to say. You just don't think that something else. What you say is right. And it's a great online workshop. We've got several thousand people that have enrolled on it since we launched it in April. But it's these three judges that are speaking to you as one-on-one, like we're talking to each other right now. And mm-hmm. What you're saying there is basically what Scott Card says.
Yep, well, he's right. Do say hi to Dave for me. I saw him 2 years ago at the master class that Dean and Chris put on.
Uh-huh.
In
Las Vegas?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And reconnect with him. Yeah, the nice thing about Las Vegas is between getting laid off my job in Seattle and working for the Navy, I worked for the Air Force at Nellis there in Las Vegas for 2.5 years. And we have a number of friends there who happily put me up, which helped the bottom line on
on that trip.
It was still really neat seeing all those folks again. That's the other thing that new writers need to think about. if they want to really get a feel for it, go to cons. Go where they can meet people who are writing and are being published or self-publishing even. And you find out that they're just as human as you are. A lot of new writers, it's almost like it's a published writer is a deity of a sort or something, or a minor deity. That's not true. We're just bums. But it's, with a gift of gab, mm-hmm. and it's not that big a deal. I think that there's a lot of mystique about being a writer, and that it's kind of worthless.
Well, there's the fact too of, as much as you want to, say it's nothing, the fact is a lot of people never get past the point of, I wish I could do that, and it's a legitimate thing. And the fact that you did it does, maybe it doesn't deify you, but it does make you a standout because you've done something that maybe they've even gotten to the point of aspiring. They just thought, wow, that's amazing how somebody could do that. You can transfer your thoughts into words and make it something somebody else will want to read and tell other people about. It is a skill. It's not something that's just like, I got the gift of gab. I can assure you, I know a lot of people with an amazing gift of gab, and they'd be hard-pressed to come out with any type of a book that anybody would be interested in. So there is something about it, the fact that you're able to do that, and you're moving up now that, you're being published by Ring of Fire Press. Which brings me to the question is, if someone wants to be able to explore you as an author, what do you recommend as a first read?
Well, okay. Luckily, I only have two children, and one's male and one's female, so I love them both equally because they're both very different. But being an author, you love all your books when you're writing them, but when they're done, there's some that you love and there's some that are, well, I'm glad I did that. The one I flat out love is Whale Song. It's been around the longest. I started it. That was the short story that I got the first honorable mention for. And I worked on that thing off and on while writing other stuff for years. And I finally got it finished, and it's a standalone. There's sets up a sequel that may or may not happen. I don't know. I've been actually thinking about that one too. But it works by itself. After the apocalypse thing, but the apocalypse is an asteroid strike. And I don't want to give a whole lot of it away, but the asteroid wasn't by itself. And it makes a big difference on Earth. And my main character, my protagonist, is an Eskimo from Point Hope, Alaska. And you follow him through a lot of change, a great deal of change. The one thing he can do, because his mother fed him the liver of a fresh slaughtered seal, which is a delicacy, or was a delicacy back in the day, because they've reverted to the old ways because nothing of the modern age works anymore. And but the seal glowed in the dark, and his father wouldn't touch it. He caught it, but he wouldn't touch it. It freaked him out. And his mother, hey, it's food. And so she feeds it in the liver, and suddenly it's like this thing swirls into his head, and he can feel his mother's feelings, his father's feelings, and it startles him so much that he hits her arm, and she's using her ulu, her woman's knife, to slaughter the seal. And she cuts her hand, and he feels her panic because being cut, there's no doctors around. And she runs into the house to get help from her husband, and he can feel everything that's going on. And as time goes on, his senses get more and more acute, and he gets to the point where by the time he's 17, he is the shaman, and he can call the animals to the hunters and fish to the fishermen and stuff like that, which is a real big deal because they live off the land. But he's also socially ostracized, and so he has, being young and becoming an adult, he has all of these emotions that he can't translate, and he feels people laughing at him, and it's he goes from being a very negative character into something quite different through the length of the book, and it's my favorite science fiction book.
Wow. Okay, so it's called Whale Song.
Yeah.
And you get it where, from Amazon or from where does somebody get it?
You can get print on demand through Amazon or the ebook or through my website, tonycompton.com. The my favorite reviews, you get not enough reviews. That's the other thing, everybody out there. Write reviews about what you read. It really helps. Even if you don't like the book, say so. We figure, you know, that makes the next book better. A lot of people just don't write them. But one review that I'd like to meet the guy. I want to shake his hand, buy him a beer. But he said, there's nothing else out there like this. He says, I read in his review, it's on Amazon. I read a lot of books. It's like a number of books a month. And he says, this is unique. And he says, this is so satisfying. And that made me feel real good.
That's great. Good. So then, that'd be a good Stoney Compton primer then to read that one there, and then you can go on from there.
Yeah, of course, you might be disappointed with the rest of them after that, but we'll see.
Let's hope not. So how can people find you? You said stoneycompton.com?
Yeah.
It's S-T-O-N-E-Y-C-O-M-T-O-N.
C-O-M-P-T-O-N, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. .com, and that's my website. I built it. It works. It's not fancy.
So they just need to find you and see what you read and find out about you. So it definitely does that.
Yeah, and I do have other science fiction. I call the Kiana series. What's funny is Kiana. I didn't realize until after I'd written the first book that that's a small village in Alaska, but it's a planet in my book. And it's about it's space opera.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed that. And I have Yana, and then level 6. Yeah, because it starts out with a crew of archaeologists who are doing a dig, and they come across this incredible find that changes everything they know about the native Kians, who are very human-like. But different and very, very docile. And they find out that they're really not all that docile. Here's the proof. And then, of course, I bring in a comet that's going to kill everybody if they don't do something. So I keep it moving. And I did a novel, Return to Kiana, which continues the story. And I've got the third book outlined. It's waiting in the queue.
Right.
I've got about 5 books in the queue that I do think about, and when I get a new idea for one, I'll write it down so I don't forget it, and which I'm getting enough ideas lately on those, but I'm always writing something.
Yeah.
The nice thing about having 2 or 3 books underway is if I get to a place where, gee, what happens next, I just go over to a different book and work on that for a while, and it's still cooking back there in the back of my head, and then I'll go, click, here's what you do, and then you go back to that one again. I don't write fast enough to suit some folks, and maybe too fast to suit others. But it's what I do, and I love it.
Well, that's good. Just in terms of aspiring writers, would you recommend Writers of the Future for someone who's
all the time? I do all the time. I spoke to when I was still living in Alaska. I left in '98, but when I was still up there, I was some of the local teachers would have me come in. English teachers would have me come in and talk to their classes in high school,
mm-hmm.
high school, junior high. And that's the first thing I'd tell them is write the best story you can. If you're into science fiction or fantasy or horror, I guess, I don't know. Get the best story you can. The first place you send it is Writers of the Future Contest, because they pay you money. They pay you money if they buy it, and they also give you a free trip outside, which... when you live in Alaska, a free trip outside is nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah.
But it's and then they'll ask me questions about it, and they'll say, well, when is it? And I will give them the address. I always have the address with me when I go to talk to young people especially. But and I've been on panels, at especially at Oricon and NorwestCon, mm-hmm. where with other writers of the future, graduates, if you will.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, we all say the same thing. Send it in. It doesn't cost a cent, and you'd be amazed what could happen.
Yeah.
And it has to happen to somebody, you know.
Exactly. Not you. Okay, great. So anything else I failed to ask you that you wanted to talk about?
I just, someone asked me not that long ago, a friend of mine online asked me how I could find time to write so much. And I told him that the problem wasn't finding time to write, it was finding time to do other things other than write, because it's totally absorbing. If I'm not writing on the manuscript, I'm researching it or I'm plotting.
Yeah.
And it's when I go to bed at night, the way I go to sleep is I lay there and I think about the plot that I'm working on and what happens next. And there have been times I've gotten up and sat down in the living room and wrote for another half hour just because I don't want that to go away. And that's
yeah.
the other thing. You get an idea and you're going to sleep, push yourself, have that pad and pen by the side of your bed, write down the idea. If you don't do that, it's gone.
Yeah.
At my age.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Tony. It's been really a true pleasure speaking with you.
It's been an honor, and I really appreciate this opportunity. And good luck with this. This is great. I really like listening to your podcast.
Great. Thank you. And thank you for listening. Subscribe to the Writers of the Future podcast wherever you get your podcasts. The Writers of the Future podcast is available on SoundCloud, iTunes, Google Play, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, Player FM, iHeart, and Spotify. Writers and Illustrators of the Future are contests created by L. Ron Hubbard to provide a means for the aspiring writer and artist to be seen and acknowledged. It is free to enter and open to new and amateur short story writers and artists of science fiction or fantasy. Great. Thank you very much, Tony, and keep on writing those books.
You betcha.
Okay, great. Okay.
All right, bye-bye.
See you later. Okay, bye-bye.